Welcome back to Tangential Banter, ladies and gentlemen. I am Ben Mowell, and I'm here with my co-host, Jack Korzenowski.
What's up, y'all?
A classic line from a classy guy. As we roll on through season three, got 8 episodes behind us already. Going along at a pretty good clip here.
Yeah, we've found a nice normal rhythm, unlike before. So unless something stops us, we're just going to keep cranking them out. Gives us an excuse to hang out at least once every 2 weeks, even though we already hang out like at least once or twice a week anyway. But the more the merrier.
The more the merrier. And in this case, it's not more people makes more merriment. It's more hangouts make more merriment.
That's right.
So, Jack, why don't you introduce our topic for today?
Yeah, so I think this was an idea of yours some time ago when we put it on the list. What's the youngest age a human could survive on their own? And whether that means, like, you know, in the wild or just in life, in society as it is today, you know, maybe we can have fun with that little nuance of the question. But it stands. What is the youngest age a human could survive on their own? Which is going to be pretty old, which is kind of embarrassing as a species.
Yes, we should be embarrassed on behalf of our young.
Or is it the adult's fault for not, you know, developing the babies more before they're born? You know, like if somebody is hired into a company or onto a team and you don't train them adequately and they get, you know, released into their role and they're doing a bad job because they don't know what they're doing, is that their fault or is that their manager's fault?
But I mean, in this case, what if the employee is not even capable of being trained for that role? You know, kind of a chicken or the egg scenario.
I was saying that in the sense of by the time they're released to go do their thing, they are not prepared. So, for example, like a baby shark, when it's born, it's on its own and it's ready to go hunt things and eat them. Like right from the get-go, that thing is ready. It can live life. Humans can't do that. Even in like the frontier world, like I think we could, like I think the nuance of the frontier or like in the wild versus in society today, it's like, well, you know, in the frontier or in the wild, you know, let's say hypothetically a 7-year-old could take care of himself. A 7-year-old in this world is not going to really know how to do taxes or know how to apply for a loan for a mortgage or, you know what I mean? Or be able to get a job. Heck, they couldn't get a job because of child labor laws.
Yeah, take that, street urchin, trying to survive.
But there are so many other species where there's a lot of species where they're born and they're like sea turtles, right? They're born, they have to make it from the beach into the water without getting eaten, which is pretty arduous task. But then after they make it into the water, you know, that's it. They're on their own. And they survive.
I would propose that we start with milestones in a person's life that establish, you know, we can work our way up and look at each milestone and talk about, well, does that mean that they could survive on their own? And then I think doing so, we could build up to an age where we would say it was reasonable that they could survive on their own.
Okay.
So like the minimum age would be, and I'm saying minimum as like, I don't think this is the actual age, but it couldn't be less than this, would be what's like the earliest premature baby that survived with the highest medical attention and everything is like 6 months, right? Or something like that from conception.
Oh, so, you're talking about a prematurely born baby?
Yeah.
Okay. So born at 6 months instead of the usual 9. I see. Okay. So 3 months. Wow. 3 months early. Yikes.
I think that's the earliest. I don't know the exact numbers, but it's very, very early. And that requires intensive medical care, months and months of medical care, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of treatments and attention and all the best technology and everything. Right. So we can pretty easily deduce that a child in that situation is not going to survive on its own, right? It's obvious right. from the treatment that it gets that it can't.
It can barely survive even with teams of people trying to get it to that point.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So if we move on from maybe what you could consider a simple case there, we look at maybe the next step or one of the next milestones in a child's development, which would be walking.
Yep.
Right. So that'd be anywhere in the 1 to 2 year range. I guess there's crawling and there's walking, right? But so it can walk, but it can't communicate and it has no ability to feed itself at that point, right?
Like, yeah.
I mean, I guess if it was in, if it was like living in a pool of food, I guess it could eat, it could feed itself, but it has no capacity to go obtain more food when it runs out.
By capacity, do you mean like recognizing mentally, oh, I have to go do this versus like it may recognize that it has to do it, but it physically can't or either?
I would say both. I think it would know that it was hungry, but it would just be like, I don't see anything edible here, so I'm just going to go hungry.
Gotcha.
And even if it could identify that it needed to go get food, you know, does it know where food comes from? Right.
Right. And also, I mean, babies have to have breast milk for a period of time too. So sure. It's not even like, even if it had the physical capability to go get food and the mental capacity to recognize I have to go get food to survive, it wouldn't be able to really digest anything. It wouldn't, there would be no food around because there'd be yeah. nothing it could eat.
Yeah, I think it passes that point usually before walking. Like it's, I don't know. I haven't reviewed my child maturation timelines recently, but
didn't do your homework usually for the topic then, Ben.
Well, we never really do homework.
That is half the fun, just going in cold.
Yeah. So I think, anyway, walking milestone, I would say they still can't care for themselves at walking. Another big one is the whole potty training thing, right? Now, I guess you could ask the question of how necessary is that for survival? If you were able to just take a dump wherever you wanted and people didn't care, would you survive, right?
Right. And, or
I guess
I would say in the wilderness, that's the answer. In if you're surviving in the wilderness is different than if you're surviving in society.
Yeah, I think we're saying in the wild, right? This is without a civilization to help you.
Okay. Sort of like, was the spirit of the question in recognition, like, hey, animals can, you know, survive on their own within, you know, maybe like a year. A lot of them can. A lot of mammals can. But humans, nowhere close to that. So what is the earliest we could survive on our own? Was that like the gist of the question?
Yeah, and I think it somehow came up in the context, because you mentioned the frontier life connection. I think it came up because we were talking about if you had been on the frontier and your parents died from some disease or a raid from Native Americans or something, right? And you're left all by yourself, like, how old would you have to be for you to not just die shortly thereafter?
Oh, you know what? This brings up another nuance of the conversation, which is this child that has to fend for itself. Did it, well, I guess it would kind of have to have parents or caretakers ahead of time where it could have learned some things that it would need for survival? Because if you have, for, I guess, yet another nuance is it has to have, inherently, it has to have caretakers before this minimum age, right? Because then it would never have gotten there, because the whole point of the conversation is
determine, right?
It would have died by the point it got to the minimum age if it didn't have caretakers.
Right.
Because if it didn't die, then obviously the age is less than whatever we're talking about. But anyway, are these, like, were its original caretakers also living on the frontier and could teach it skills to survive? Like, intentionally teach them how to go get food, how to prepare shelter, how to tell which plants are poisonous versus good for eating? or these like, you know, city slicker parents where heck, even the parents probably couldn't survive out in the wilderness, much less like, you know, their small child.
Yeah, I would make it kind of somewhere in the middle. So I would say like, this would be a child who's old enough to recognize it has a need for shelter and to protect itself from the elements, you know, from sun and cold and whatever, but hasn't necessarily gotten specific coaching on how to best do that.
Okay.
That's my interpretation anyway.
So my gut feeling, and I'm probably maybe jumping to the end, but I would guess somewhere between 7 and 10 years old. Because I think if you're younger than that, you're not going to have the mental capacity really to understand poisonous food versus not poisonous food, that you have to kill animals and, you know, how to prepare their bodies properly so that you can eat them.
I mean, it does raise an interesting question of how, at what point do we learn to recognize food in our development, right? Because, for example, an apple, right? You could see an apple on a tree, and if you've never had one before, no one's given you one to eat. What is that, just something inherent in your, in our DNA that's like, oh, that looks kind of good, maybe I'll go try eating that thing? Or is that just you've had, someone gave you an apple before and it tasted good and you didn't get sick, so you're like, oh, that's food, right? So to what extent is that a
inborn
hardwired thing versus, yeah, the nature versus nurture question?
I would bet if you're out in the wilderness and you're hungry, that you would start to become quite ambitious with what you what you taste for food versus not. Like, I bet a lot of it would be, even if it wasn't inborn, you would quickly just say, dude, I need something in my stomach. So you start just like trying to eat random stuff. And you could tell pretty early on if it's, you know, if something's edible or not. You can't necessarily right away tell if something's going to be poisonous or not, or going to make you sick. But so that would be trial and error. But I would imagine if you just saw like an apple or an orange or some other fruit in a tree, and you're in the state of, dude, I need to find something to put in my belly, you would look at it and even just through rationality say, that looks promising.
Yeah. And I think you could fairly quickly eliminate a number of things, right? So let's just say trees. You try nibbling on some bark, you're like, man, this is really tough. Like, your body is going to tell you pretty rapidly that you're not designed to live off of that food, right? Just because your teeth don't crush it well. It doesn't taste particularly good. I guess you could fill your stomach with it if you really tried. But, and then, so there's your own biological signals that, yeah, this isn't really food for me. Plus, you could also, maybe without even consciously realizing it, notice what other animals are eating, right? Mm-hmm. So you might see squirrels eating nuts, or you might see deer eating leaves or grass or something. And those would be clues to you that like, oh, they eat it, so I could probably eat it too.
Obviously not everything, but yeah, that's a good idea, or like a good observation. That brings up a little nugget I learned somewhat recently of acorns. Have you ever tried to taste an acorn?
I think when I was younger, yes.
I tried one, I think I was in like late high school, and they're really stinking hard. Like, it hurts to bite into them. And then two, absolutely disgusting. I have heard that people have tried making dishes out of acorns. Like, if you cook them right, the taste can, like, the really bad taste can go away. But apparently it's not easy. But one of the things that makes them, one, taste really bad, and two, if you actually eat enough of them, they can make you really sick. There's tannins in them. And that's what makes them taste bad. But then I also learned that, you know, the word tannin, like tannins in wood or tannins in like wine or other foods, that's the same word where we get, it's the same root word where we get like the tanning process from, like to tan leather or to tan your skin. it comes from tannins, because what apparently they would do is they would take these tannins and they would treat leather with them, and that's what makes this animal skins into leather. So they called it tanning them. And that's where the word tan comes from. All right, let me rephrase that. I think the word tan and then the word tannins come from the same root, because the process of tanning leather uses the tannins. The more you know.
The more you know.
So where were we? Oh, yeah. If you observe like what animals are eating. Now, here's another question. Would you, if you were raised young enough and you didn't quite conceive that people ate animals, like that you may have eaten meat in your life, but if you never saw your parents or whoever hunt the animal, kill the animal, dress the animal, cook its meat, and then serve it to you, if you didn't watch all that, if you just get the flank of meat on a plate and that's all you know, would you, in like, would you connect the dots and be like, hey, I can eat animals? Or would that thought just never come to your brain?
That's a good question. I think, going back to your earlier question, assuming that you had some sort of a caregiver up until whatever age you were able to live on your own independently, I think you would have, at that point in time, been exposed to enough things like fruits and vegetables, and you would have had the basics of meat comes from animals, right? So even if you'd never seen one hunted or whatever, I think you'd have to be pretty young to not have an inclination as to what food sources there are.
Right, and perhaps too young to survive for some other reason.
Right, yeah, I think so.
So we've been talking a lot about like food gathering. We haven't touched so much on shelter. And then two other things are popping up in my brain. One of them is fending yourself off from predators. And then two, treating yourself when you get sick or injured.
Yeah.
I think those two things require smarts, and particularly for the defense against predators, like physical, like you need to be strong enough and fast enough to either outrun them or, you know, beat them up.
So I think you could go down two paths. You could take an ideal scenario, right? Like say a tropical island somewhere in the Caribbean, right? Where the weather is, there's not really, if you have water and food, there's not really a concern that you're going to die from exposure unless you just laid out in the sun and burned forever. Mm-hmm. And there also aren't significant natural predators, right?
Okay.
Like there are things like snakes and whatever, but nothing that's going to prey on humans. I feel like that'd be about as ideal of an environment you could get for those questions that you were just asking.
Sure. But then what, so about the ideal thing, so that would help us determine the minimum, right? Like under ideal conditions, what's the youngest a person can fend for themselves? So if you move into, if as soon as you start introducing less than ideal factors, what?
Well, I'm laughing because where my mind immediately goes is there are environments on this planet today and people, adults of sound mind and relatively high intelligence, who couldn't survive on their own, right? They couldn't build shelter strong enough to survive an Iowa winter, right? Or warm enough to survive an Iowa winter. Or they couldn't fend off a wolf or a bear or a mountain lion, right? So sure. I think if you go with less than ideal conditions, you pretty quickly ratchet the minimum age up to the point where it might not even be possible without specialized training at any age.
Right. I see what you're saying. Or at least for your average person.
Right.
So you had like a survivor man parent who taught you all this stuff, and then he died, and then there was an apocalypse, and then you're on your own. That's going to be different. If you were raised by me.
Yeah. So like a 12-year-old Inuit child, right, in the Arctic Circle, probably has a much higher chance of survival in the wild there than a 40-year-old person with no specialized training, right?
Wait. Did you say Inuit?
Yes.
Is it pronounced Inuit, or is it enunciated Inuit, or is it enunciated Inuit?
I don't know.
I've only ever heard Inuit, but Inuit, interesting. I'll have to look into that. That's the difference. We were having this conversation once. That's the difference between enunciation and pronunciation. Inuit versus Inuit. I'm not pronouncing them differently, but I am enunciating them differently. I'm putting the different stress on a different syllable.
Well, that's just mispronunciation, but...
Syllable. There we are. Now I pronounce it the same.
Yeah, so I've always... I think we disagree on this.
Maybe we'll have to come back around to it. Or should we... Well, yeah, I want to go back to the survivorship topic before we really go rip a tangent on this one, but I'd be fine with ripping a tangent on enunciation versus pronunciation too.
So enunciate, according to Merriam-Webster, there's several definitions, but the one that in this usage, it says to utter articulate sounds. So enunciation is the crispness with which you deliver each element of a word sound. And
okay.
Pronunciation, I want to get dictionary from the definition from the same dictionary. Oh, wow, that's helpful. The act or manner of pronouncing something. Thank you. Pronouncing, relating to or indicating pronunciation. Wow, could they be more circular? These literally just link to each other. There's no definition.
That's too bad. Come on, Merriam-Webster, you're usually so good at this stuff.
They just point to each other. Oh man, that's bad.
You know what? I'm just gonna go right to the source, which is Google. Enunciation versus pronunciation. Okay, I'm just picking the first link. Pronunciation and enunciation are closely related terms that often get confused with each other. So let's see what they say. Pronunciation is related to the word itself, focusing on which syllables should be emphasized and how certain letters or combinations of letters should sound when spoken. Enunciation refers to how clearly and distinctly a particular individual forms the sounds that make up a word. Okay, so according to this article, pronunciation encapsulates both the specific phonemes, and the stress of the word. So Inuit versus Inuit don't have different phonemes, but we do emphasize one syllable or the other differently between those two examples. If I said emphasize, I meant stress.
Yes. So where do we end up on that?
Well, according to that, what's the difference between, what's articulation? There's another one. What's the difference between pronunciation and enunciation? This is from the English Language and Usage Stack Exchange. What's the difference between pronunciation and enunciation? I learned this a long time ago in English class, but forgot what it was. The top answer says, say the following aloud, being very careful to say each syllable very clearly and precisely. February. Now do the same for this. February. Your enunciation was good with both, though your pronunciation was only correct for the second. Okay. Pronunciation is the act of properly clustering each group of letters to make the correct sounds. Enunciation is the act of clearly speaking in order to allow someone to understand. So what I'm not seeing consensus on is, does pronunciation include, so, you know, does quote, properly pronouncing something, end quote, include where you put the stress in the word? I'm not getting consensus on that from what I'm reading, but what I am getting consensus on is that whatever that stress placement thing is, it's not enunciation. That's something that's just like making sure you speak clearly. So I was wrong about that all these years.
Dictionary.com says pronunciation is the act or result of producing the sounds of speech, including articulation, stress, and intonation, often with reference to some standard of correctness or acceptability.
Oh, okay. So they do, and what's articulation then? Pronunciation versus articulation.
The example they give is they are arguing about the pronunciation of forte again. So it's spelled F-O-R-T-E, right?
Yep.
The correct pronunciation is forte. But I'm sure there's someone who pronounces it fort, right? Which would be the incorrect pronunciation. But they could enunciate correctly. Fort is very clear and distinct that they're saying fort, but their pronunciation of the word is incorrect.
So what I don't like about that, about grouping all of those aspects of speech into just pronunciation without having any breakdown further than that, is that forte is the proper pronunciation. Fort is not the proper pronunciation. Forte is also not the proper pronunciation.
Yes.
Which is a bit like, I wish there was a, okay, you got the sounds right, but you got the emphasis wrong. Now, somebody may argue, well, isn't emphasis, doesn't that make it a different sound? I would say, I'm going off of the... you know, like when you look something up on Wikipedia, if it's like a foreign name or a name or like a noun that doesn't come from English, it gives you the IPA breakdown of how to pronounce mm-hmm. the word.
Yeah.
So what I mean by different sounds are if the IPA like code would be the same, but you just have to put the stress on a different part of the word. That's what I mean by pronunciation. Pronunciation is you write the word down with the same IPA symbols, but you're it doesn't account for where you put the stress. So Inuit versus Inuit would use the same IPA symbols. I don't know if they actually would. I don't know if there's a subtle
don't they,
change, but
I thought they accounted for that by what's capitalized versus lowercase.
That's not IPA. That's a different system. I can't remember, but IPA does have a, they do have a way to indicate stress. But it's not different symbols. There's just like, it's like a little apostrophe. You put the apostrophe at the end of the stressed, at the end of the stressed syllable or at the beginning. I can't remember which. But so you could have the same string of IPA characters minus the apostrophe. And all the apostrophe would do is move locations. So you could say that those are two distinct strings, sure. But it kind of defeats the, because that apostrophe is not actually pronounced. It's not actually said. It's a silent symbol to indicate where the stress is, but it itself does not represent a sound. Whereas everything else in IPA does, except for glottal stops, which represent the lack of a sound.
So I'm coming up with a kind of a working thought here that enunciation is only an internal standard, essentially, in that have you transmitted clearly the word sounds that you believed to be appropriate? And then pronunciation is, does what you enunciated match with the accepted standard of how that word is supposed to sound?
Yeah. Sounds about right.
That's the closest I can get putting it in my own words.
How it sounds in including stress. Because again,
correct.
So using forte is a good example. I used to think, so remember, forte is the word in question and forte is the proper way to say it. I used to think that fort would be the wrong pronunciation of it. And forte would be this the right pronunciation, but the wrong enunciation. You're putting the stress in the wrong place. Because forte versus forte, The sounds are the same. You're just stressing one versus the other. In IPA, they'd have the same symbols. It's just that the apostrophe would move different places.
Yeah. So one example would be the word cacophony. I used to think was cacophony.
Cacophony.
Because that's how it, if you sound it out, right? It's C-A-C-A-P-H-O-N-Y.
Yep.
And so it has all those sounds and it's like, oh, cacophony. But then it was a vocab word in my English class and the teacher said cacophony and was like, what word is he saying? It was like, I couldn't match it up with the vocab word almost. But I mean, that's the whole process of learning when you've read something, but you haven't heard it said. And how many times do people screw that up where you don't understand the pronunciation of the word? You know what the word is, but you don't know the pronunciation of it.
Take that Family Guy joke. Honey, what was that sound? Oh, don't worry. It was just the wind. It's wind, dear. Oh, I guess you only ever read it.
Yeah, it should be wind, right? It is wind.
It is wind. Cases. Yep.
Yeah. But you did, you brought up the word articulate, which I was actually thinking in the back of my head as we were having this conversation, because there can be articulate and then there can be articulate, right? And they are they're the same spelling, and there's three meanings there at least, but they all come from the same Latin root word, articulus, which is a small connecting part, and then articulare, which is divide into joints or utter distinctly.
I remember, but I think, back in season one, we talked about how we can have the same word pronounced in two different ways, whether it's like, you know, a verb versus a noun. Articulate versus articulate, that's a verb versus an adjective, interestingly enough.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Sorry, I interrupted you. What were you saying?
No, I was just going to say the articulate verb, if you're talking about like a mechanical linkage, right, means that it can flex, it has segments and it's flexible. And articulate means to express an idea or feeling fluently and coherently.
Mm.
And so I was just thinking about that. If it comes from the idea articulate and articulate, that like your tongue is flexible and is able to form these different words, complex thoughts or whatever. Mm. Or if your thinking is that way, you know, like it's based on the shape that makes someone an articulate person or able to articulate words well, based on that thought of being flexible and segmented.
And I know articulate, the verb, can also mean like you articulate an arm, you kind of move it around, or you articulate a lever, to the point where it's like you're sort of extra, you're moving it around with those joints.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we went down that tangent, rewinding the clock back to our main topic. We still hadn't arrived. We were talking about the minimum age and ideal conditions, like in a tropical island somewhere. And I was just trying to think, because we've said so far, like, whatever potty training age, I think, is still too young to survive on your own, even under ideal conditions. So the questions you'd asked about were shelter, caring for yourself if you're sick or injured.
Yep. We're ignoring predators.
And staving off predators, yeah. So shelter and predators kind of go away in that scenario, right? I mean, you've got to have some shelter, but assuming there are like trees, you're not just going to sunburn forever.
Or, yeah, there's like, I mean, you'd have to protect yourself from maybe storms. But that may not be as much a life and death thing as much as a, look, you can just sit out in the rain in a tropical storm, and it would suck. You're not going to die, you know, assuming it's not like a hurricane, which, you know, the winds are so strong, you might literally get ripped up and thrown into the ocean, or debris might come flying and kill you. But you don't have to worry about extreme cold. That shelter requires much more intentionality and skill and to put together. And if you're living on a tropical island, your shelter doesn't have to be that impressive.
Right. It could be a handful of leaves thatched together to give you shade. That's what you'd need.
Yeah. And I would think on a tropical island, food would probably be plenty and you'd come to recognize it pretty quick.
Right. Yeah. Especially if you've already been exposed to its source, right, before your caretakers were gone.
Yeah.
So that leaves caring for yourself if you're sick or injured. Man.
That's a real crapshoot, though. That's the problem.
It also depends on the severity of it, right? Because even today, as an adult, I couldn't care for myself with if I had a stomach ulcer or something, right? Or cancer, any of those things, you got to have medical treatment. So,
well, let's assume, because at that point,
bind a wound, basically?
Yeah.
Right?
Like if you get injured or if you get a cut or a wound and it gets infected, you know, can you treat it before it kills you?
Man, I feel like the knowledge even to treat a simple, like a flesh wound that could get infected, you'd have to be, I don't know, 8 or 10 maybe to really retain that.
Yeah. I'm not even sure if I could do it. I mean, what do you have to do to treat a wound to prevent infection? So let's assume that they have to treat themselves to prevent infection, and they have to realize that they have to do that, you know, proactively enough to where they can prevent infection, as opposed to, okay, kid, you just woke up, you got gangrene on your left leg, go, you know,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Fixing an infection is a lot more difficult than preventing one. So let's assume that how old do you need to be to prevent an infection versus fix one?
Yeah. And I was going to say also, I think you're helped at this point by a child's, the strength of their immune system and their body to fight off infection, right? Like at the youngest ages, it's not very good, but as you get a little bit older, it gets stronger and stronger. So what I was going to say is, essentially, I think unless you had, I don't know what you'd do without modern chemicals, except two things. One of them could be, if there's a wound that you have that needs to be cleaned, would be to wash it out in the ocean, because it's salt water and the water's going to wash out any dirt and debris or whatever. The salt potentially will kill anything that would be trying to infect you. Basically just pickle it.
Is that true? Like, is actually washing a wound with seawater, will that kind of help sterilize it a little bit? I was thinking that, but I don't trust my survivorship skills to make sense.
I believe so, but I'm not 100% sure. Yeah.
It may help. Like, and I would think, my intuition says it would help, but it's not going to be like a magical cure-all solution.
Yeah. It's certainly not going to be as potent as other things. The other option would be to cauterize it.
Oof. Yeah.
Which would be painful, but if you knew how to do it, it would be pretty simple.
Would a kid have the capacity, like the mental and emotional capacity to do that? I would say no. Maybe not until they're in, maybe right before preteens, like maybe 10 or 11.
Yeah, there is salt water does kill many types of bacteria by osmosis.
There you go.
It removes water from the bacteria.
Just salt them dry.
Yep.
I take it that's bacteria that you pick up from on land. If you somehow get infected by something in the water.
Sure. Yeah. Then you got to fill it with sand.
Yeah. Or just let it dry out. Yeah. Because then that's the only way. Give more salt water is not going to help. That's where it lives. It was born in salt water, molded by it.
You didn't experience salt water until you were already a man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have those movies on my docket to watch on the Hulu.
I haven't watched the third one in a long time.
Yeah, me neither. So I want to.
You will pay.
I remember when I saw that movie in theaters, I was like watching it. I was like, holy cow. I can't understand a word Tom Hardy is saying. It was really bad.
Yeah. That vocal effect was not helpful, in my opinion.
I think they actually
very distracting.
I liked it. I think it made sense, but it was just overdone to the point where I could not understand what he was saying. Like when he was, it was like, that's what it sounded like. And then I saw it a second time in the theater, like maybe 2 weeks later or so. And it was a lot better because I had heard that they had sent out new, like they had fixed up the audio for him and sent out new reels or something. And it wasn't 100% better. Like there were still some points where I was like, yeah, I can't understand what this guy's saying, but it was noticeably improved.
I remember thinking at the time, like the first couple scenes where you heard his voice, that it was like a cat on helium or something.
Or a cat on what is it? Sulfur heptafluoride?
Yes. I have no idea what that is.
You don't?
No.
I think it's sulfur heptafluoride. Let me look that up. Sulfur heptafluoride.
Sulfur hexafluoride?
Hexafluoride, yeah. Sulfur hexafluoride. So it has the exact opposite effect of helium. Like you can breathe it, but it makes your voice sound really, really deep.
Nice.
And the reason why, so helium makes your voice really high because it's really, I wish there was a word for, you know, light is the opposite of heavy. I wish there was a word for that, a same word for that for dense.
Undense?
Yeah, it was very undense. That doesn't sound right. I know it is right. It just sounds weird. But helium is really undense, so it makes the sound waves travel through them faster. And I think your vocal cords can vibrate faster because it's lighter than air, and hence that's why your voice sounds so high in helium. Sulfur hexafluoride, opposite story. It's a really dense gas. And in fact, in my chemistry class in college, the professor had like this aquarium. And she looked kind of nuts because she was explaining what she was doing. Like she explained sulfur hexafluoride and she just, I think she had like some sort of canister. Like, so imagine like a big coffee thermos and she was pouring it into this pitcher and she was being really careful with it, but she's just pouring a colorless gas out of this pitcher. So she was slowly pouring this thermos. Nothing's coming out, looking really intently at it. She puts it down in the pitcher. She slowly moves it over and slowly pours it into this aquarium tank. And it looks like she's absolutely off of a rocker because there was nothing coming out of the thermos. There was nothing in the pitcher this whole time. But then she had like this little boat made out of aluminum foil. And she put it, she did this thing with the pitcher a few times and she put the boat in the tank and it just floated. In the middle of the air. It was so cool.
What would also be cool is that you could, if you had a scale sensitive enough, you could put the scale underneath the tank, right? And tear it before you start pouring in the pitchers. And then you're pouring in pitchers that look like there's nothing in them.
Yeah.
And then the weight of your fish tank is increasing.
I'll have to send you a video. But yeah, our listeners, look up sulfur hexafluoride, hexafluoride, sulfur hexafluoride.
So what I actually said earlier was sulfur hexafluoride. Like it was a very slang term.
Yeah, sulfur hellafluoride.
Yeah, we talked about that, didn't we, with the prefix used for the mass of the sun. I think that was the episode we recorded over the holidays while I was back home in Michigan.
Oh, yeah. We did record that recently, didn't we? Yeah, it was hella, right?
Yeah, 10 to the 27th.
Gosh, it's so awesome. They should totally stick with that.
Yeah, I don't know if they actually committed to that as an official designation or not. It was kind of one of those, like a Bodie McBoatface scenario.
Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh. I love that story. They didn't actually name it that, did they? I know it was, it won the vote, but
I don't think they did. I think it was superseded.
That's so stupid, man. Respect.
Although, there was a group that was trying to name a mascot a Tableau mascot. And
what's a Tableau mascot?
Tableau is a software that's used for creating data visualizations.
Oh.
It's like a high powered visualization tool.
Okay.
And one of the suggestions, they had created a list of like pre-approved ones that people could vote on, and somebody commented like, what about Tableau-y McTableau face? And they ended up choosing Tableau Timmy is the name of the mascot, and all I could think of was Timmy from South Park.
Yes.
It's like, oh man,
I have to admit, though, I like Tableau-y McTableau. I can't even say it.
I know it's hard to say.
Tableau-y McTableau face, because it does not roll off the tongue whatsoever.
It does not.
Yeah. It's so obviously just going after the most ridiculous name they can. Such a meme. Like, McBoat face rolls off the tongue really well.
Yeah, right.
So that would actually kind of be like, yeah, we can do it, but Tableau-y McTableau face. Like, if they went through with that, it's like, this is no chance this is not out of a joke.
I felt like the mascot itself should have been the old Microsoft Clippy paperclip. I keep advocating, like, Microsoft came up with Cortana, right? And I'm like, man, they really missed their opportunity. They could have made their digital assistant Clippy revive this old tradition. It would have been great.
It would have.
Or like, if you could choose a avatar for Cortana that is Clippy, and it like flips back to the, I guess Clippy never had a voice.
Well, that was
big old time. Smile though. Yeah, we can give Clippy a voice. We should start a hashtag, give Clippy a voice.
Don't like, yeah, like uncensor Clippy.
Free Clippy?
Free Clippy.
No.
Let's do it. Free Clippy.
Free Clippy.
We'll have to include that in the when we release
the episode. To all our millions of subscribers out there.
Yes.
Use the hashtag Free Clippy on all your social media to pressure Microsoft into creating a new digital assistant in the likeness of the original Clippy. With a voice.
Now, here's the question. Who should voice him?
Oh, dang.
That's how about Tom Hardy in his Bane voice?
I thought you were going to say Tom Hanks at first. I was like, the old Woody Clippy connection there.
Oh, it would make sense. Like, just Tom Hanks would be a good, you know, person to do narration and stuff. But no. What would it be? I forget the exact line, but
sorry, go ahead.
I was gonna say I'm trying to think. Nah, I can't come up with anything. I was gonna, you know, you merely had, like, or I was born in the, I don't know, Microsoft word. You only adopted it after you became a man or something. But I can't remember the scene too well. It's been a long time.
I was born in binary. Molded by it. I never saw Microsoft Office until I was already a man. No, I think Clippy should be voiced by Nicolas Cage.
Oh, yes. He probably just wouldn't care and just like just go all out on it.
You've tried to click delete. Are you sure that's what you'd like to do?
That's pretty good, man.
There's a shoot. Oh, it's so this is one of the tricks that I've learned in my life is you can get better at doing impersonations by impersonating someone who impersonates that person.
Huh. I guess because then you can kind of pick up on how yes. They're changing their voice.
Yes. And so they'll clue you in onto that person's like tells and ticks, right?
Yeah.
So what the voice that I was doing right there was actually probably closer to Andy Samberg's impersonation of Nicolas Cage.
Oh.
Than to Nicolas Cage himself.
Well, it worked. That strategy works. That was pretty good.
There's actually a really good set. I think Nicolas Cage hosted SNL and he did a sketch with Andy Samberg impersonating Nicolas Cage. It's pretty classic.
Hey, wait a minute. This reminds me. I just saw a video kind of like that same concept where there was the person in with the same video as somebody who's impersonating him. It was Tom Cruise and Ben Stiller pretending to be Tom Cruise.
Oh, I saw that like on my feed, but I didn't actually watch the video. I need to check that out.
Yeah. And now that you mentioned this whole, if you watch somebody who is impersonating somebody, you'll know what to do a lot better than if you watch the original person. I can totally, like, thinking back on that, I remember thinking, oh, that's what makes Tom Cruise Tom Cruise. Because mm-hmm. you can see what Ben Stiller was doing, like how he was articulating his voice and like his mannerisms and just what he was saying.
Yep.
Yeah. And I was like, man, Ben Stiller did a pretty good job. I'm not a Tom Cruise aficionado, but I'm convinced.
I think it also helps because it reflects the public perception of the person being impersonated, right? So you're both reading the same person and it's like they're getting the same message that you're getting. And so it helps. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but it's,
I'm not tracking what you're saying.
So like you don't necessarily know much about Tom Cruise, but your impressions of Tom Cruise are likely very similar to the impressions that Ben Stiller has of Tom Cruise, right? Unless they've had a lot of personal interactions or whatever. If he just knows him, you know, from, you know, they've met a couple times or whatever. What he knows about Tom Cruise is from scenes in movies or from interviews or whatever, right? If they haven't spent a lot of time together. So in that regard, like you're both reading the same script.
I see.
And so it's like the things that stood out in film as like his attributes or whatever, maybe that's not really what he's like, but that's all that either of you know of him. So it's like your sample size of the subject is the same. It's a limited sample, but it's the same data set.
Yeah.
So you're both able to train on an identical data set.
We're working from the same source material.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's not just the person as the source material. It's the selection of that person's work that you're able to see and view, right?
Right. The movies he's been in, shows he's been on, interviews
right.
that you can watch.
Right.
We're all we're me and Ben Stiller are watching the same videos.
Yes.
And it's the same media. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Makes There's sense. Another example that's really good, or a couple of them actually. So Bill Hader on SNL did Keith Morrison from NBC's Dateline. It did his impersonation multiple times. And since that happened, they've actually met up in person and done some like face-to-faces where it'll be like Bill Hader doing an impersonation and that Keith Morrison is just responding in his normal voice. Pretty hilarious. And then there's one where SNL with Chris Redd did an impersonation of ESPN's First Take and Stephen A. Smith. And it's just so ridiculous, but it is spot on. It's hysterical.
So I'm not too familiar with the ESPN, but back in the day, did you ever watch Mad TV when you were younger?
No, I didn't. We didn't have a TV when I was really young. And then when we did have one, we only got over the air channels. So
have you ever heard of Mad TV?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm familiar with what it is.
So they had one of the cast members was Frank Caliendo. Do you know who that is?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Like really good impersonator. And his impersonation of John Madden always got me laughing so hard.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Because he did that on... was it like Sunday Night Football or something when Madden was still an announcer?
He did. I've never watched ESPN regularly, but I think he did that impersonation on like, I think some commercials. I think he did, or am I think actually thinking, I might be actually thinking of John Madden on that one, but he did it elsewhere, not just on Mad.
It reminds me of when George W. Bush was president, he at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, you know, they always have a comedian come and talk, but he actually had Steve Bridges, who's like the most well-known George W. Bush impersonator, who came, and they like gave a co-presentation sort of thing.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I do appreciate though, like, you can tell, I don't know, it's kind of like a roast, right? People who can play along with an impersonation of themselves and like see the humor in it versus the people who are like, well, that doesn't sound like me.
Right.
It's like, well, it does. You just don't like how it sounds.
So. Yep. You got to be able to make fun of yourself.
Yeah. Makes life a lot more fun.
Does. Just so exhausting to get angry about things all the time. Like, I see people who get angry like really quickly, or they get really, or like they get worked up about something, kind of more or less out of the blue. And yeah, likely, is there something else going on? And this is just sort of the trigger. It could be, but at the same time, it's like, dude, like, I just couldn't imagine caring that much.
Yeah, I get that. And it's, again, it's one of those things that you're punishing yourself, right? Because you're unhappy with the situation and then you're angry, you're complaining about it. And it's just compounding the situation that you already don't like. And I mean, you can make other people suffer, sure, if you really want to, but that doesn't make your situation any better.
Well, you're going to do, like, if you're, you know, making a big deal out of something, you're ruining it for other people, regardless whether you're meaning to or not. Which sure. is unfortunate, because then you're just making everybody else feel nervous and on the edge, and that's not going to help the situation. You know, like when people start freaking out at work about one thing or the other, that makes other people freak out, and people start kind of panicking, and that doesn't really. I mean, it'll help in the short term, or in the short term, you know, you get what you want, but that's going to hurt things later on, because things are going to be done in haste and out of fear.
Yeah.
Out of fear.
So I want to button up our primary topic. I think the conclusion that we're drawing is, under ideal circumstances, your best case scenario would be, I guess that's redundant. Under ideal circumstances, you could survive at 8 to 10 without any caregivers or society to thrive off of.
I think so. I mean, maybe as young, well, I was going to say maybe as young as 5, but like, let's say you had 100 of these situations. I would bet, or like, let's say you, oh, this sounds horrible. Let's say you stranded 50 young, like 55 or 105-year-olds on deserted islands with plenty of food, no predators, the weather's never gets that bad, or if it does, it's not really life-threatening. How many of them would end up surviving? I bet there would be some 5-year-olds that did end up surviving and growing up.
Wow.
But one, let's not test that.
You would be a great sociologist.
Let's not put that to the test. Let's just leave this as, you know, a light speculation.
Continue.
I was going to say, I would bet there would be some 5-year-olds, but I would say like a good threshold for... You have, and maybe we're looking at this the wrong way, Ben. Maybe there actually just would be a linear like percentage. Like, the older you get, the better chance you have to survive. And there's no real cutoff. But unless that cutoff is really early, like let's say four years old or something. But I think that, you know, we're looking at a 4-year-old and say, chances are you leave a 4-year-old out in the wilderness or even on a deserted tropical island, he ain't going to make it. So where's like that realistic cutoff? I would say in an ideal situation, probably closer to 7. I think if they got into that survival mode, I think we would probably be impressed with what a kid that young can do.
I was just thinking about how old are the boys in Lord of the Flies? Not that it's reality, but.
And well, they're not intended. Alone either.
Yeah, they're not by themselves, right? They're not isolated. But so the youngest ones in that group were 6 and the oldest are between 10 and 12.
Oh, so they have preteens kind of help to help the young ones and to be the brains, as it were.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. But what this, I mean, through all this conversation, okay, so we've established a young, ideal youngest, or an age at which a young person could survive on their own. Let's say that's 10% of your full lifespan, right? Which it probably wouldn't be in that scenario, but we could say 10% of a best case scenario lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hefty chunk compared to other types of animals.
Yeah, I would say that's way up there for other types. Like, we're definitely on the butt end of that stick.
Late bloomers, as it were.
Which gets, did I send you, I sent somebody a meme. Let me see if I can find it. Kind of related to that same concept. Oh yeah, here it is. It's wild to think that perhaps the only animal who needs to wipe its butt cheeks is the only animal capable of inventing toilet paper.
I don't think you sent that to me, but...
No, I didn't. It was another friend of mine. But isn't that, like, you know, it's kind of funny, isn't it? Like, the only, like the animals that can't survive, that have really bad survival in their youth phase, I don't know what to call it, are also the animal best equipped to remedy that situation.
Sorry, I was just reading a discussion thread of, like, which animals are up there with humans. It says chimps become independent between 6 and 9 years of age, but they only live to be 45.
Well, is that, when they say independent, do they mean like they can't survive? Like they can't realistically survive on their own? Or is it just like the social, okay, I'm going to go, I'm moving out, mom and dad.
Well, so like in this case, where'd it go? This, I have no idea if this is accurate or not, but one commenter said that elephant calves may not be weaned for 5 to 10 years.
Dang.
Yeah, that's a long time.
And how does it say how long an elephant's lifespan is?
They can live to be up to 100, I think. 70. 70. And apparently orangutans in Sumatra and Borneo live to be 45 to 50, but they also nurse until they're up to 9 years old.
Holy cow! So other primates are kind of in the same boat. Maybe not all of them, but...
Did you say primates?
Yeah, primates.
Nice.
What?
I like it. Not primates.
Wait, is it primates?
Yes.
Oh, snap. I've been using the Pokemon for how many years of my life now?
It's for primates, a Pokemon term.
Primeape is, yeah, he's a Gen 1 Pokemon.
Primeape. Yes. You've been sabotaged, my friend.
That's what's the term when like marketing gets something in your brain like that, and it's like a Freudian slip, yeah. But it's not like you want to get it on with your mom. It's like you're repeating stuff from advertisements. There's a term for that. Maybe it's still a Freudian slip. You know what? No, we got to power the internet.
I was just thinking malapropism generally, which we've talked about before, but I don't know of a specific term for repeating something you've heard in an advertisement.
Oh, maybe this is it. In psychoanalysis, a Freudian slip, also called parapraxis, is an error in speech, memory, or physical action that occurs due to the interference of an unconscious, subdued wish or internal train of thought. Classical examples include slips of the tongue, but psychoanalytic theory also embraces misreadings, mishearings, mistypings, temporary forgettings, and the mislaying and losing of objects. Cool. Oh boy, Freud himself referred to these slips as Verleistungen. I think that was pretty good. Verleistungen.
Yes. I was trying to find like the term Xerox or Kleenex or something, right? Where the brand name becomes household and it replaces the generic term or Velcro, you know?
Band-Aid.
But Windex. I'm not seeing an actual term for that. It's a known case, but.
Well, what's it called when a brand name becomes a commonly used word? The process by which a trademark becomes generic is known as genericide. What?
Yeah.
It usually occurs when a brand attains, such widespread recognition that it loses its connection with the company that first created it, and customers begin to use the name of the product in place of its original trademark version. That sounds right. But genericide? That sounds a little violent.
The version I found is genericization.
Genericization.
But that's a mouthful. Yeah, genericide implies something died, right?
Well, the side things, like that genericide makes me think it's like killing the general case or the general term, which is kind of, maybe that is why it's called that, because it's taking over. It is now it took over the boat.
It is the general side.
Yeah, it went up to the general term, said, look at me, I'm the general term now.
Yeah, I'm your general.
Well, here it is. A sign in a supermarket using Jell-O generically rather than gelatin dessert. Gelatin dessert? No wonder they replace it with Jell-O. Can you imagine saying, please get me a gelatin dessert?
Well, what if they said, get me a pudding and then brought you a sausage? Wouldn't that be a treat?
Ah, yes. That whole shtick. It's a little late to get in another tangent. But, listeners, long story short, the word pudding in English used to mean sausage. And it's a very interesting story on how it eventually came to mean, like, what it means now, like the dessert of pudding.
Like a custard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Language is weird, my friend.
It's so cool. I like it a
lot. Lots of rabbit trails to follow with that, for sure.
Indeed.
Well, here we are at the end of all things, or at least at the end of this episode.
Can you tell how long it's been recording? I can't.
No. I'm going to say an hour and 10 minutes, approximately.
That sounds about right.
But we've successfully determined that you should probably be at least 10 if you decide you want to live life on your own out in the wild. And if you don't have a decision, I hope you're 10, at least. And good luck to you in that.
Indeed.
So for the rest of you who are not living in the wild and plan to tune in next time, we will catch you then.